thinking about using artificial intelligence for sort of the creative sphere of things, like being an artist, you know, being able to throw, you know, some verbiage into an image generator and create it in 5 minutes where it would take a painter hours to do, and kind of, well, what did you just do there, right? You took the dignity of that person's work away for the purpose of efficiency.
And realizing that it's not an evil,
Right.
but it's not a solution to everything either. And so we need to be comfortable always wrestling with the use of AI and at any moment saying, is this something that I should use AI for? Is this something I should be putting more of my own self into? Is this something that I should actually be giving to someone else to do? And so there's not always a clear cut answer.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, I think that's what's part of being human.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to another episode of Nerding Out with That Nerdy Catholic. And as we shared the last episode, Cesar is taking a short break from recording episodes. So we would ask that you keep him in your prayers. He is still looking for a job. And as we said before, the job market in Peru is not that great right now. So keep him in your prayers. But as we shared the last episode as well, Leah has officially joined the That Nerdy Catholic team. And so Leah and I are continuing our look at Magnifica Humanitas. And as we said our last episode, that there's so much in here and it is so dense that we had originally thought we were going to do the introduction in one episode, and we realized that that was just not going to do justice to it. So that we're going to be continuing to look at the introduction to Magnifica Humanitas this episode. But before we get started, I want to remind you that if you go over to thatnerdycatholic.com, you can sign up for our email list and get updates when we put out new episodes. If you go to thatnerdycatholic.com/merch, you can get Nerdy Catholic swag, t-shirts, mugs, and prints to show the world that you can be a nerd and a Catholic at the same time. And you can go to thatnerdycatholic.com/support to help support us financially. Our expenses here at That Nerdy Catholic have gone up, and any financial support you can give would be greatly appreciated. You can send a one-off tip or join as a monthly supporter. So, Lee, time to jump back into Magnifica Humanitas.
Let's do it. I am so ready. Before we start, too, I did find this. I don't know if you saw, but the Vatican did release an audiobook version of Magnifica Humanitas. Maybe we can link to that, but it's really interesting. They break it down by chapter, and it's a really nice human reading through it and really professional. So maybe those that are listening along, if they're wanting the audiobook version of that, there is one that's out there that's free, and it's a really, really nice listen. Yeah.
In the show notes, I definitely want to get that. My wife and I, on a long drive last week, we listened to part of it. There was a podcaster that had read the entire thing.
Oh, wow.
So that was good, but it was kind of hard with his intonation. And I don't know what it was about how he read it. It was a little bit more difficult to listen to. So I definitely want to check out the official one. But yeah, I downloaded the ebook version of it to read on my Kindle. So.
Oh, good. Yeah. I really like the ebook version of it too, because it kind of, you can get to the footnotes and things. And I'm kind of one of those footnote nerds. Every time something is referenced,
I know. And it's so easy to just tap. Actually, the one that I got, the footnotes didn't work. So I need to look up to see if there's one with the footnotes that actually work.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think we said that a couple of podcasts ago, maybe the load on the Vatican website and how we were so surprised that you know, everyone is being able to access, you know, kudos to the Vatican website. They do a pretty good job with these encyclicals. You know, they've got all the links functioning. They got all the footnotes functioning. I mean, they actually do a really good job with this online. So pretty nice.
And someday the whole Vatican website will look like the homepage and not like that old worn out paper background.
Yep, the old paper background. I'll miss it for nostalgia's sake.
That's true. Well, every once in a while we can go to the Wayback Machine.
That's true.
To relive the old Old Glory days.
That is true. That is true. It's amazing to think, though, just in that vein of thinking, how quickly we can all access this encyclical and all at the same time. And thinking about, we talked a little bit about Rerum Novarum coming out in 1891, and just the difference there between 135 years ago, how people would have accessed an encyclical from the Pope, and how many people would have been able to read it, and how quickly, and versus right. what we're doing with this. I mean, instantaneously, there's, you know, millions of people across the globe that are dissecting this encyclical and seeing everything that the Pope wrote. So kind of a
right.
interesting thought, isn't it?
I know.
We're able to look at this stuff. So,
yeah. Well, and as you said, the servers that they must have to run this website, it's not a complicated website, but this is a website that people from all around the world are accessing all the time.
Yep. They must have quite the IT team. We should get them on the podcast someday.
That would be awesome. The Vatican IT team. Yeah. Well, let's jump in to Magnificat Humanitas. So when we did the last episode working through the introduction, we realized that there is one section that was really the main summary of the introduction for this whole encyclical. And so we wanted to pull that out and focus on that today. And so that section was this section on the two biblical images that Pope Leo wanted to look at as far as how we consider really how we work together. And this is not just about AI. This really is building upon the work of Rerum Novarum, and how do we look at work, and how do we look at our role in being productive in the world?
Yeah.
So I'm going to start off, I'll read paragraph 7. In order to answer these questions and discern how to navigate responsibly the era of AI, I would like to bring to mind two scenes from the Bible. The construction of the Tower of Babel from Genesis 11, 1-9, and the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem from Nehemiah 2-6. The story of Babel appears in the book of Genesis, at the origins of humanity, immediately after the genealogies of Noah's sons. After settling in a plain in the land of Shinar, the people decided to build a city and a tower, quote, with its top in the heavens, Genesis 11, 4. Fearing being scattered across the earth, they sought to guarantee stability and power for themselves, and above all, to make a name for themselves. It was an impressive feat, a single language, a single technology, a single direction. However, the project concealed a profound danger. It was a project conceived without a reference to God, supported by a uniformity that eliminated diversity and that chose homogenization over communion. When a city is built on pride and the claim of self-sufficiency, communication breaks down, languages are confused, and people no longer understand each other. The result is not unity, but dispersion. Babel thus reveals the limits of any effort that, however grandiose, arises from self-affirmation, sacrifices human dignity for efficiency, and aspires to reach heaven without God's blessings. There's a lot in there, but growing up in an evangelical church, I had always heard the lesson of the Tower of Babel of God punishing a people from without based on the fact that they built a tower, that he didn't like that they were doing this. This image of the pride involved and the fact that what happened to the people that built the Tower of Babel was as much their own doing as what God did to them, I think is very powerful.
Interesting you bring that up. Of course, coming from an evangelical background as well, this was kind of a proof point of why we should all be speaking different languages in different countries and should never mind to this sort of one world government, because that's what's going to bring about revelation and the end of the world. Yeah. Right. So, you know, this was kind of the first stab at
Babylon.
Right. Exactly. You know, and what's interesting about this, that line supported by it was a project conceived without reference to God, which kind of reminds me of, I was reflecting a little bit on that audiobook version of it, of the encyclical. And then in paragraph 2, just that beautiful line that talks about the church. And Pope Leo says, she, the church, recognizes history as the place where the gospel challenges and directs human experience. Mm-hmm. And here he's saying, you know, this was a project concealed with profound danger because it was conceived without reference to God. So again, he's bringing that whole look, without reference to the Bible, without reference to God, we don't have, you know, a good barometer to, you know, show us whether or not we're moving in the right direction and things like that. Supported by the uniformity that eliminated diversity and that chose homogenization over communion. And I love that word because it's not that, it's not that it's a problem that we're all working on the same thing together, or that even globalization in and of itself is a bad thing, as long as the people are in communion.
And, absolutely.
And, right. Yeah. And that's kind of what was interesting in this paragraph, is that idea of communion, you know, and oneness in diversity and oneness in our uniqueness as humans versus assimilation versus the Borg.
Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah. And thinking about this, this was one of the things that I wish would have been in Rerum Novarum, because this image completely fits into what Pope Leo XIII was trying to teach on the Industrial Revolution.
Right. Especially when he's talking about sacrificing human dignity for efficiency. That line right there, you know, this is 135-year-old Rerum Novarum versus what we're reading today, and it's the same problem. Human dignity for the sake of efficiency.
Well, and that line is so powerful to me, because it goes past this almost intellectual exercise of talking about industry, talking about corporations, talking about others and their problems to my own problems. I mean, this is a problem that all modern people have, this dependency on efficiency.
Right.
I mean, how many times have I been stressed because I have felt, well, what I'm doing right now isn't efficient enough.
Right.
And I need to remember the image of, I can't remember the exact lyrics of the song, but the extravagant love of God. It was a worship song that came out about 20, 25 years ago. But that image of God's love as almost as wasteful, because it is so extravagant and he pours it out on us so much. And we are sitting here trying to be so efficient. And what happens when you are trying to be so efficient? You overlook people, you take advantage of people. And I think that's one of the main points he's trying to make on the Tower of Babel. And I love that you brought out that one line, shows homogenization over communion.
Right.
If you are doing things with communion in sight, then you are taking the value of each person as God created them. And you're not saying, well, you're not really worth spending time on because you're not efficient enough. Everyone has something to give.
Right. You know? Yeah. Boy, I love that. I was reading that last line of that paragraph, you know, especially when it says sacrificing human dignity for efficiency and aspires to reach heaven without God's blessing. I was thinking, wow, how many times I've even myself in the pursuit of efficiency have never just stopped to ask, you know, is this even what God wants me to do?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a big question, but I love how you're sort of framing this as well, as it's not just a matter of, hey, is God wanting me to do this singularly for efficiency's sake? Is this something that I should even be working on? But you're also saying that, like, the character of, you know, the attribute of love that God has for us, if we're not also sharing in that attribute for love for others, we're completely missing the point. I mean, he's all about, you know, chasing us down and finding us. And, you know, I think you're talking about leaving the 99, that whole song, right?
Yeah.
That's the whole idea. And if we're not in kind acting like that, if we're sacrificing human dignity in order for us to just move forward in productivity, and we're leaving behind, you know, humanity or those around us or our neighbors, then mm-hmm. we're not even acting the Christian, right? And that's a great way to look at it. Yeah.
Well, and we are called as Christians, we are called not just to be moral people, and we're definitely not called to enforce morality for everyone around us by saying, you know, this is, you know, as if we were all morality police, but we are called to be Christ-like. And that is a big part of it.
Yeah.
But one of the things I also was thinking about when I was reading through this paragraph is this idea of my daughters go to a classical school, and they have a pledge. They, you know, they have morning assembly every day. And so one of the last things that they do in assembly is they say the school pledge. And the school pledge is, I will do the good, I will learn the true, I will love the beautiful.
Mm.
And since God is truth, love, and beauty, anyone who is focused on doing something good, knowing something true, or loving something beautiful, then they are, whether they know it or not, they are connected to God. Now, right. Then this is not a universalist kind of view that, well, everyone has God, or we are all God, or any sort of view along that line. But the image that I love thinking about this is the end of the last battle. And I looked it up this morning, and I'd forgotten that this character had a name. But there is a character at the end of the last battle. His name is Emeth, and he is a Calorman soldier. So this is the nation that is the enemy of Narnia. And we have this image that C.S. Lewis gives us of heaven in the last battle. And this character, Emeth, makes it to heaven. And he's confused why he's there, because he sees Aslan. And they have this back and forth. And Emeth is basically saying, why am I here? I'm your enemy. I have followed, you know, Tash, who has been your sworn enemy forever. So I've followed him, so I don't know why I'm here. And I just want to read this one quote of what Aslan says to him. And Aslan looks at him, he says, I take to me the services which thou hast done to him, to Tash. For I and he are of such different kinds that no service which is vile can be done to me, and none which is not vile can be done to him. Therefore, if any man swear by Tash and keep his oath for the oath's sake, it is by me that he has truly sworn, though he know it not, and it is I who reward him. And if any man do a cruelty in my name, then, though he says the name of Aslan, it is Tash whom he serves, and by Tash his deed is accepted. That image that you can't truly do anything evil in the name of God, and you can't do anything truly good in the name of Satan.
That's a really powerful image that we touched on a little bit last time when we were talking about some of these, you know, bigger billionaire, trillionaire organizations and individual organizations, and whether or not they're doing good versus evil. And I love that you pointed this out, because it's whether they know it or not, you know, if they're operating in, you know, that charity, you know, goodness, truth, and beauty, then they're absolutely operating in the, again, those charisms or those attributes of God. And, and you know, they're doing right for humanity, versus someone that would say, I don't know, maybe creating an AI agent that's, you know, Catholic or Christian, and they're absolutely evil, but it's like, but it's Catholic.
Right. It's so easy to put a stamp of Christianity, of putting images or just the outward appearance of being Christian. I mean, you think about what Jesus says to the Pharisees. He's like, on the outside, you look great, but you are whitewashed tombs.
Right.
On the outside, you look great, but you're dead inside.
Yep. And it's by the fruits of these things too. You know, what is the output? What is the fruit? Because through that, we're starting to realize whether or not this is something that is in line with the gospel, you know, in line with God's view of heaven on earth and what it would mean for humanity to be in communion and oneness with God versus the alternative. And that's a pretty strong image. Yeah. But while you're reading that, I was just thinking, why would that be like an Anthropic? You know, would they be that soldier, you know? And it's like, well, whether you knew it or not, you're right. You didn't serve me, but maybe there was this little bit of hope that was sitting there. And yeah, that's really good.
Yeah. Well, let's just jump into the next paragraph then so we can do a compare and contrast between these two images.
Sure.
So paragraph 8, the book of Nehemiah in turn opens at a time of great vulnerability in the history of ancient Israel. After the Babylonian exile, a portion of the people returned to Jerusalem, but the city was still in ruins. The walls collapsed and the gates burned, from Nehemiah 1 to 2. Nehemiah, a Jew in the service of the Persian king Artaxerxes, received news of the disastrous state of his ancestral city. Before taking action, he fasted, he prayed, and interceded for the people. He then asked the king for permission to return to Jerusalem, and upon arriving, examined the destroyed areas in silence. He did not impose solutions from above. He convened the families, assigned each of them a section of the wall to rebuild, listened to their concerns, coordinated their efforts, and addressed any opposition. The narrative shows how the city is reborn, not through the initiative of one man, but through the shared responsibility of all. Men, women, priests, artisans, heads of households, and young people all played a part. It is an undertaking with God at the center, which rebuilds relationships before rebuilding with stones. Thus, ancient Jerusalem rediscovers a common language, not one of uniformity, but one of communion, namely the harmony that arises when all persons assume their own role and recognize that their strength comes from the Lord.
Mm. You know what I really like about us doing this is reading this a little slowly and going through the analogy of both of these things. It really brings to light the how different these two images are. You know, there's the self-sufficiency. There's the unity, but dispersion. There's the self-affirmation, sacrificing human dignity for efficiency in the Tower of Babel. And here you have what we were talking about earlier. Here you have communion. You have people that are, the artisans, the priests, the men, the women, the heads of household, the young, the old, you know, they're all playing this part. So they're all in communion with each other, bringing their differences into this thing that they're building. And that's what sort of affirms this blessing from God that you're doing the right thing, because this is something that's affecting everyone positively. And boy, that's such a strong image for artificial intelligence. You know, it's who are we leaving behind and who are we not leaving behind? And if that's the litmus test, I think it's really easy, just thinking off the top of my head, to spot some of those things that are like, ooh, that could be a dangerous road for artificial intelligence if you're starting to leave behind. You know what I thought of? I mean, you said artisan, and I know you've talked about this in the past on podcasts before, but just thinking about using artificial intelligence for sort of the creative sphere of things. Like being an artist, you know, being able to throw, you know, some verbiage into an image generator and create it in 5 minutes where it would take a painter hours to do, and kind of, well, what did you just do there? Right. You took the dignity of that person's work away for the purpose of efficiency.
Yeah.
And that was a Tower of Babel moment versus what you would have here with the, with Nehemiah, where it's like, you know, bring this in. Kind of interesting to think about.
And realizing that it's not an evil,
right?
But it's not a solution to everything either. And so we need to be comfortable always wrestling with the use of AI, and at any moment saying, is this something that I should use AI for? Is this something I should be putting more of my own self into? Is this something that I should actually be giving to someone else to do? And so there's not always a clear cut answer.
Yeah.
But I think that's what's part of being human.
Right.
I mean, the idea of efficiency also goes to, there is not always a set answer that is super obvious at any one moment of what you should do. And in my men's group a few years ago, we read through Josef Pieper's book on the cardinal virtues, which it's a powerful book. It's just called The Cardinal Virtues. So if you ever want to learn more about the virtues, this is a great place to start. But the mother of all virtues, prudence, is that at any one moment, you need to take a look at reality around you. You need to take a look at the world around you. You need to take a look at yourself and your place in the world around you. And you need to, because you need to make a decision every moment of your life. You're always making decisions, whether it's big or small. And you need to say, all right, here's how I understand the world. Here's how I understand my own actions at this moment. And you need to make a decision. And as humans, they're never going to be perfect.
Yeah.
And they're almost never going to be completely 180 degrees to perfect.
Right.
But you need to make a decision and then you need to evaluate and say, okay, what I just did, you know, how right was this and how wrong was this? And then you need to say, okay, well, but that's what I did. And then you move on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. But so thinking about the use of AI, it would be wonderful if it were just a simple answer of, well, this is great, so use it all the time, or this is the Antichrist, so never touch it.
Right.
But we need to always be evaluating our actions.
Sure.
As we're doing it.
So something that's striking me as we're reading through this too is it isn't necessary. So we're talking about AI as a tool, right? And we're kind of mentioning, and I think later on in the encyclical, the Pope also talks about that. It intrinsically in and of itself, it's not anything. It just kind of takes on the characteristics of the humans that are running it. And we'll get to that at some point. But, you know, it's interesting that the Tower of Babel and the wall, it's not about the tower.
Yes.
And it's not about the wall. Right. And so, and we keep kind of talking about AI as the tool and maybe it's, this is the thing. Should we be putting that brick into the wall or should we be putting that brick into the tower and how we're building it? And I think those are good questions, but what is the tower for and what is the wall for?
Right. Right.
You know, and I think that's maybe the deeper question that this encyclical is trying to get to is let's lay the tool, let's lay the thing aside for a second. Let's lay the tower or the wall aside for a second. What is it that we're doing? And I'll get to that in a second. But first, I wanted to mention that Nehemiah is one of my favorites because when we're talking about sort of business side of things, this is like leadership 101. You know, this guy comes in and he kind of gets everybody together and he gets them all excited and hyped up about a singular thing. And what's interesting about this that the encyclical doesn't speak to is that when the community pulled together, this wall was rebuilt in only 52 days, which was just like an unheard of feat, of feat, right? How quickly it was done. Just because of the shared labor mentality of it. And this is where Rerum Novarum kind of gets in and we can probably nerd out about this in a later podcast, but it's sort of that whole, you know, which section of the wall is ours, you know, instead of trying to boil the ocean. It's like, Seth, you and I are just sitting here, you know, in our own offices and, you know, AI, we're such a small piece of the pie, right? But you know, we're only in charge of, you know, what God's given us ownership of and how are we good stewards to that and everything else. But, you know, what is it that we're building the wall around? And what is it we were building the Tower of Babel for? And, you know, is it, and I put in our notes here, the question mark, is it human knowledge? You know, is that what we're building the wall around? You know, is that what we're trying to preserve and protect? I'd love your thoughts on that, because I think the Tower of Babel was sort of, we're building this tower of human knowledge to compete with God. And the wall was, we're building a tower, we're building a wall around human knowledge to sort of nurture and protect it. I don't know. It's kind of an interesting way to look at it.
On that note, then, Lee, I when I was reading through this paragraph this morning, it brought to mind the idea of open source software. The rebuilding of the wall as open source software. And the thing that I love about open source software is that you don't have anything that's enforced. It really is a community thing. One person starts it. One person comes up with an idea for a piece of software and they start working on it and they're passionate about it. And then they get to a point and they say, well, I need help with this. Most nerds that decide that they want to do a software, they don't have tons of money. They're not going to start a company. They're not going to go out and hire a bunch of people to help with this. So they say, well, I'm going to open source it. I'm going to make this free and I'm going to put it out there. For one thing, there's a vulnerability there.
Yeah.
To say, I'm assuming that other people are going to like this and want to help out with it. And so they put it out there, whether they put it on Reddit, wherever they put it, to announce that they put it out there. And then other people start playing with it. They start using it. And they're like, oh, this is really great. And then a small percentage of the people that start using it say, well, I think it would be really great if it had this feature or if it had this function. Mm-hmm. And they download the source code and they start playing around with it. And then they say, well, I think this part is good. I'm going to push this back. And it becomes this community effort that feels very much like how Pope Leo is describing the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem. And Nehemiah is that first developer that puts it out there.
Yep. Yep. There's a cultivation there that's happening. You're putting something out there. You might not know everything, or you're even admitting that this is my piece of it. Now others help contribute to make this the best that it can be in the spirit of whatever you're building in that freeware. If we can just side tangent for a second about vibe coding. Because I think this is where, you're talking about freeware and you explained it so beautifully. Like, look, here's this thing. I've created it. I'm throwing it out there. I'm putting myself out there. It takes a little bit of humbleness and separating yourself from the ego to say, look, I think this can benefit other people and you're wanting others to contribute. You mentioned something really important. There's source code that you're able to look at.
Yes. Yes.
And a lot of times now I'm reading Reddit and people are like, guys, I just solved the problem of this app that I've been wanting to solve for years and years. Look what I created. And the first question that comes out of people's mouths is, show me the source code. because they know, like, this thing has been completely vibe coded through AI. And it's really incomplete. And the problem with that is that even if you were to pass that on, it's a one and done, right? You can't even continue to cultivate this thing because you've thought this process up yourself and you're throwing it out there to the world, but you're not able to continue the engineering of the thing. And I think there's just a problem with just this kind of AI slop of software out there right now and just rot because they've reached their complete culmination through this weird phenomenon of vibe coding. And now I'll step off my soapbox.
No, I completely agree. And, I created a small tool with, I think it was with Base 44 last fall. And it was a simple tool that I needed, doing the directing of the journey home. And I said, well, I think it'd be really great to be able to have a tool that can have a clock running and that at any moment I could hit a key and jot down a note and then keep going so that I have notes that are time coded. And I couldn't find anything out there with a quick search. And so, I'm just going to try this, try Base 44. And I did, and I made something that worked. And I'm like, okay, this is cool. I'm not going to share that. I'm not going to say, hey, look what I made, because I didn't. And yeah.
So there's a difference between sort of the as a programmer, hey, look, I just built this tool because it's for myself. It's contributing to some sort of efficiency thing outside of just a bunch of sticky notes on a page, right? Of time cards or things like that. But as a programmer, you're also using a little bit of prudence, you know, and you're looking at this thing and saying, look, this is for me. This isn't for the world and how grand and wonderful I am. And I think maybe that first paragraph kind of talked about this a little bit, that, you know, the claim when a city is built, I'll just kind of read it from that paragraph again, when we're talking about that Tower of Babel, when a city is built on pride and the claim of self-sufficiency, communication breaks down. And, you know, us as programmers, we're kind of doing the opposite of that. It's like, oh, I'm not being prideful at all. That tool's for me. But if you were to say, you're welcome, universe, I just built this, you know, sort of time stamping tool that the world has needed. And
yes. Well, and the fact that anyone could do the same exact thing.
Right. Right.
It shows that, no, I'm not contributing anything to the world.
Yep. Yep. The instantaneous.
Which is fine. Economy. And there's not a problem with that.
Right.
How many times do you need something and you just... at home and you throw something together with glue or duct tape or like, I'm not showing this to the world. I don't even want people to see it, but it was something that I needed at this moment and it worked.
Well, and this talks to this is where Rerum Novarum comes in a little bit, that encyclical from 135 years ago, and just the dignity of the human person and the economy of a thing. And I think we touched on this very briefly in a previous episode of one of these podcast was about work in AI, is the economy and the scale of the thing. You know, you can vibe code something, and if even a couple thousand people think it's worthwhile, you've all of a sudden become, you know, a multi-thousandaire when before you had nothing, right? So you've sort of turned.
You might even become a hundredaire.
You might become a hundredaire, but you didn't do any work for it, right? And there's this mentality of, hey, maybe I create this thing and there's enough buzz around it and I throw it out to the world and all of a sudden I've become this millionaire because I created this great app that only a small subset of humanity needed. But it was enough to at least kind of throw me into this, you know, sphere of influence because of the money that I'm making off of the tool. So that's an interesting subject as well, is because the singularity around that. You know, not really benefiting anyone other than yourself, and kind of doing it as a get rich quick scheme is really dangerous. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so let's go on to the next paragraph then. In the light of these two images, the Holy Spirit challenges us today regarding our relationship with technology and the ongoing digital revolution. Scientific discoveries are talents entrusted to humanity so that they may bear fruit. He's referencing Matthew 25:14-30.
Mm-hmm.
Technology has the power to heal, connect, educate, and protect our common home, but it can also divide, exclude, and generate new forms of injustice. In the abstract, technology in and of itself is not a solution to humanity's problems, just as it is not inherently evil. In practice, however, technology is never neutral because it takes on the characteristics of those who devise, finance, regulate, and use it. Therefore, the primary choice is not between a yes or no to technology, but rather between constructing Babel or rebuilding Jerusalem, between a power that claims to dominate the heavens and a people who work together in the presence of God to rebuild the walls of fraternal coexistence.
Boy, this—I don't know about so you, powerful. But when I read this, this is a trigger. Well, it's the last part of that paragraph, Seth. I think for a lot of Catholics that I know, and I love them, but they're Luddites. You know, you read. Therefore, the primary choice is not between a yes or no to technology, but rather between constructing Babel or rebuilding Jerusalem. I think a lot of people are thinking, oh, we were really hoping this was the encyclical where Pope Leo was going to say AI is evil and we need to absolutely combat
it. Put the kibosh on it.
Right. Right. And right here, he's kind of putting his, you know, just paragraph 9 right at the beginning. He's saying, nope, sorry. Look, the choice isn't should we use it or not use technology. No, that's not it. That's not even the question.
It's too simple.
Way too simple. Yep. Not even the question. It's how you use it. right? Yeah. We know the benefit of it. It's how we use this. Are we seeking the things that need to be sought first? You know, the gospel, the will of God, all of these things. Are we doing it to work together and coexist in the presence of God to rebuild these fraternal walls that he was talking about, which is a beautiful line? Yeah. Are we doing it to destroy human nature? And so for all of those out there that are wondering, why do we have a Nerdy Catholic podcast? Because the question is not yes or no to technology.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It is a lot more complicated than that. And right. And as I was saying before, with the issue of prudence, we need to use prudence on all levels, whether it's our own use of AI, all the way up to we need to question the motivation of the people that are creating and training the AI.
That's right. And okay, yeah, so we
and so this idea then that came to my mind is like, we've talked about this before as far as the hardware requirements and software requirements of especially training AI. You know, is it possible to create an open source AI system that is not controlled by someone? You know, because the issue with open source software is that you are using your own computing time, your own processing time of your computer to write the code, to compile the code. You're using your own internet connection to upload the source code so that other people have access to it. And then anyone involved uses their time, their computing power, to download the software, to download the source code, to edit it, and then to put it back out there.
Right.
And then, you know, there's the, you know, wherever it's hosted, you know, there are sites out there that are dedicated. And then so there are groups of people that have put in the time and the money and the effort to create these spaces that people can share the source code. So there are people that are involved on all levels to support this endeavor of allowing there to be this open, free source software out there.
Right.
But with AI, we're hearing stories all the time about all the data centers that are going up to train all these models. And so the money for that has to come from somewhere. And so then how do we, especially as people just using it, and resources, so how do we as people just using it, how can we say, well, we need this to be more open when the level of the control is so much above us?
Hmm. And it reminds me of the old days in business where, you know, every organization had this. It's like, well, who houses all of the data to our organization or our customer management system? Oh, the server under my desk.
Yes. Yep.
Right. Yes. You know, and it was so localized. And then it wasn't until, you know, a couple of, you know, maybe 15 or so years ago when all of a sudden it was like, oh, well, let's take that really risky server under that person's desk that he can, you know, spill coffee on or kick over, and our entire business is lost to, let's just throw that in the cloud and not think about it because of its safety and security, and it's replicated across, you know, seven different continents or whatever it is. Right. And, but so I guess my point with that is that this isn't anything new, but I don't think even for the last decade or so, anyone's ever thought about, well, when I throw something in the cloud, like, what does that mean? Like, what resources are being used? You know, at what cost was that data center even built? Where is it in the middle of Antarctica? And what wolves did it? Is it, you know, I don't know. All the questions.
Displacing, right?
Displacing the animals, right? So it's, but we're not really thinking about that. And, and you know, that's, and part of that might not even be our responsibility. But I do think at least knowing where our food comes from, right, is a good exercise.
Yeah.
Right.
I remember the .com that I worked at back in 2001. We had all of our servers at a data center about 3 miles away. from where our office was.
Mm-hmm.
I think I went down there a couple times a month. And we had a cage, and I'm trying to remember. I think we had 5 or 6 racks mm-hmm. of servers. So it was more than just under the desk, but there we could walk up and say,
our
stuff is running on these machines right here.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we had a couple high availability environments in a few different cities, but you were able to drive up, you know, there were usually guarded, you know, by armored guards and things like that.
And you had the few people on your team that had a key card.
That's right.
To get into the data center.
Right. Right. But you could see those things, you knew you could touch them and feel them, you know, you had to replace components and parts. So it was much more, you were much more involved in the process than I think you are today, where it's so easy to separate yourself from all of that work being done. I suppose, unless you're in that space and working in those environments, because of course they're not humanless yet until we put a data center in space, like Elon Musk is proposing. Right.
Let's not get on that tangent.
right. Well, so it's kind of until we get to that point, you know, it's really the effects of this thing. I like that road you're going down, because it really does kind of it does explain a little bit, you know, the component aspect of the things, the open sourceness of the things, the communal and fraternal aspects of the things, and how much of that can be lost or discarded quickly when you. Yeah. Especially in the digital era, when, you know, you're just throwing a thing on the cloud, or you're just using AI and you don't realize, you know, whatever it is, how many bottles of water, you know, ChatGPT is using and all of this stuff. But
Well, and you you get your monthly AWS bill.
Right.
And then that's taken care of.
Right.
And one of the things that is kind of frustrating to me in a lot of conversations, not just around AI, but in a lot of conversations today, is this black and white capitalism versus socialism.
Mm.
That if it's anything other than this corporate running of everything, then you must be talking about socialism. And so that's where I love the idea of the open source model, because it's not capitalism or socialism. You know, you think about, you know, people have talked about the early church in the book of Acts. It's like, well, they were socialists. It's like, no, they weren't. They were just a community that had everything in common. But they were a community that had everything in common because everyone chose to join this community and throw all they had into the pot.
Well, and they understood each other's needs.
Yes.
Right. And that was a big part of it, too, is they were able to, you know, sacrificially look at other people's needs and help fill the gaps where they were needing to be filled. It wasn't, this is a great point and probably another tangent we can go off on for a long time, is the idea of socialism is kind of like, no, you're required to put things into the pot and then we'll distribute it based on whatever we think are the necessary conditions. That's a lot different than Seth, you saying, hey, I could really use X. And it's like, oh, I have one of those. Like, here, we're in community. You take it.
Yeah.
I mean, my brother, take it, right?
Yeah.
It's totally different.
Yeah. Yeah. And the realization that having humility is as much of asking someone for help as it is giving help.
Right.
To be able to say, no, I have this need, and I am going to come across as vulnerable to go out to the people around me and say, I have this need, can you help me? And then to also say, I have this gift, can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what community is about. It's about giving help where you have the gifts. But it's also about going to people for help when you have the need.
Hmm. Yeah. And such a different thing than this is what I deserve, or this is what should be coming to me, or this is something that, you know, how unfair, you know, I mean, it's just such a different mentality. And I actually think a little later in the encyclical, kind of down toward the middle, it talks more about the economy of the thing. And that would be really interesting to visit as well when we're talking about this whole socialism versus capitalism, because that was a big theme in Rerum Novarum. And I think maybe a lasting tension with a lot of people who read Rerum Novarum at the surface, because it's like, well, it's anti-democratic. You know, I mean, it's anti-democracy, right? It's the opposite of what we would want or what we're seeing. And he's throwing capital, you know, Pope Leo XIII is throwing capitalism to the wind. Well, no, that's not what he was doing at all. He was just saying that there's a third way, because he was envisioning even 135 years ago, the problem with capitalism is, well, you just said it, Seth, open source, right? So you're walking into these rack mounts, you know, in your data center, 99% of that data center, you know, we're in a perfect world of, you know, democratic society. There's that pie inside of the data center would have been split totally evenly between companies. And it wasn't. 99% of it was probably Microsoft. You know, I mean, so you look at that and you think, well, you know, democracy now or capitalism, and you're like, yeah, but 99% of the ownership of this entire process is one organization that's making billions and billions of dollars. And well, anyway, we need to dive into that someday for sure.
And the whole idea of the number of people controlling the economy is shrinking. Right. And then what happens to the people that then have to charge, you know, have to pay exorbitant amounts while these people are getting richer and richer literally every second.
Sure. But at the same time, the undoing of that, you know, or the writing of that is not, well, that's not fair. Give us part of your money. I think it's way deeper than that. We need to look at how the system is set up and empower people, not through vibe coding, but empower people to be efficient and self-sufficient and make their own way, but then know that they can ask for help when they need it and that we're ready to respond. So, yeah.
Yeah. You have a great quote here from Anthropic. So I was wondering if you could read that.
Yeah, sure. Just kind of after we read that paragraph 9, I believe. So this is not the encyclical. This is Anthropic. If we get this right, AI can become a foundation for greater productivity, creativity, scientific progress, and economic opportunity for the many. And we will achieve our mission to ensure AGI benefits all of humanity. And I think until we got to that last line, we were on the same page with Anthropic. This is what concerns me a little bit, Seth, about some of these things is Anthropic is absolutely on the right track. If we get this right, we're benefiting the many, right? But the mission is not what Pope Leo is mentioning later on in paragraph 11. Their mission is to ensure AGI, which is, general intelligence that we're all kind of shooting for, benefits all of humanity, and we all have our own AGIs. And what concerns me a little bit is this reliance on AGI instead of that, what we were talking about earlier, that reliance on God. And the difference there and how we as Catholics can look at a company like Anthropic or look at AI and say, look, AGI is not the answer. You know, the answer is God. And if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and read some of paragraph 11 there, because I think this ties in really nicely. Is building a city founded on the common good implies first and foremost building on a firm relationship with God. It means recognizing that the truth of his love calls us to life in all of its fullness, John 10:10, and communion with him. Like St. Augustine, we too can say, you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it rests in you. Indeed, God has inscribed in our hearts a desire for happiness that embraces all the dimensions of life. The Church, in dialogue with men and women of our time, recognizes the urgent need to safeguard and guide this aspiration towards its deepest truth, which of course is God. And I think that's what is so beautiful about this encyclical is it's looking at what Anthropic said. Great, we're with you. You know, benefiting the many, opportunity for the many, economic opportunity, scientific progress, right? But our hearts, Seth, are restless because we're looking for God. And I think a lot of these organizations are looking for AGI.
Right.
As the answer.
Right. Well, almost, to risk sounding too dramatic, almost looking for a digital god.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and going back to what we were saying before about truth, goodness, and beauty, that I think it is too easy when you want to slap the label of Christian on something to make it limited to people that have this very specific view of God and fall within a narrow definition of what you, as the person that's setting this up, think a Christian should be.
Right.
But when you look at God, not just as someone that is loving, someone that is good, and someone that tells the truth, but if you look at God as who he is, as love itself, truth itself, and beauty itself, that anyone who is seeking love, truth, and beauty, and goodness, they are at some level of imperfectness seeking God.
Right. And again, AGI, you know, automated general intelligence.
Yeah.
Right. Again, is that the tool, right? And and we talked about that. Is that the, you know, the tower or the wall, right? That's the tool. So we're talking about the wall, but what is it we're preserving? Well, the general intelligence, is that preserving human knowledge? You know, where is that pointing to? Is that knowledge all pointing back to God? Are we constantly pointing back to our creator and all of these things that we're doing to help inform us better as humans in our discoveries in science or in medicine or in helping our common man and economic opportunities, everything that Anthropic is talking about? Is that all pointed back to this greater sense of belonging? Right? Of being children of God, you know, our hearts are restless until they rest in you because God inscribed in our hearts that desire for happiness in all dimensions.
Yeah.
And if AGI is a tool that can help us get there, as long as we're always pointing to that God-shaped hole in our hearts, being filled by God as the true source of happiness, then I think we're on the right track.
Yeah. Well, and I think we can look at not the general intelligence, but all the different artificial intelligence models out there that are specifically trained to do something very specialized. There's so much that can be done with those, whether it is medical research or solving engineering problems. There's a project a little while ago that came out where someone created this very simple pulley generator. And so you had this weight and you put it up on this thing, and I think it was like a chain or something, and then it would slowly fall and it would generate electricity and it would power a light bulb.
Oh, interesting.
But they took this technology that they created and they said, we want to raise money and we want to get this into the hands of anyone that needs it in all these rural areas around the world who don't have access to electricity. And so they went into these villages in Africa and around Asia, and they would give people these simple things that weren't expensive, but the fact that then someone could have light in the evening made such a huge difference in their life. And then they could then go and do something that they couldn't do before. A friend of mine was a missionary in Cambodia for a few years. She had an apartment in Phnom Penh, but she rented a small place out in this village in the middle of the fields somewhere. And the woman that she rented the place from out in the country, at one point when she was there, Cambodia has suffered so much since the Khmer Rouge. And so they were so far behind the rest of the region as far as, you know, economy and technology. And so they had never had a phone system, like the wired phone system around the country. And so they decided to go right from nothing to a cell phone system. So there were people that were going around building towers all over the place. And so this company in Cambodia rented the space from this woman's land where my friend was renting to build a tower. And so they were paying her rent, but also this woman had access to the electricity that the tower was running off of. So part of the rent for her allowing this company to use the land for this tower was that she could have access to the electricity. And the first thing that she did with the money that she got was she went out and she bought a refrigerator. And the change that that refrigerator had in her life is so interesting hearing my friend describe this. She could go to the market once or twice a week,
right,
instead of every day. So technology can be a great tool for us to care for the people around us.
Right.
But it can also be a tool of control.
That's a really great way to put it, because there's the practical side of technology that can help you live a more fruitful life, especially in that example with the refrigerator. And those things that are so practical, that just in living and in the care for other people and things like that. And then again, we just keep going back to it, is this idea of technology being this exploitation of humanity, you know, of the money making side of things, of, you know, the get rich quick type of things. It just total exploitation. And I think we get to that in later chapters as well of the encyclical, but just that idea that, what does he call it? I think dehumanization.
Yeah.
Where we stop becoming humans in communion with one another, and we become tools and resources for another person's gain.
Yeah.
And we lose track of what it means to be human. And that's where we turn into the Tower of Babel, you know, instead of building the wall.
Yeah, I think when we go into that, I think we can also bring in some of the concepts of transhumanism of,
oh, for sure,
making yourself into something so that you don't have to rely on others. I want to go on and read this next paragraph then, because this is really fitting into what we're talking about right here. This is paragraph 12. All too often, we place our hope in unlimited, quote, upgrades in forms of progress that exacerbate inequalities and in immediate solutions incapable of healing people's wounds. As a result, while some pursue the illusion of unlimited self-assertion, many are deprived of basic necessities. The Church reminds us with a firm yet humble voice that true fulfillment is not achieved by eliminating weakness, but through harmonious growth. It is found where freedom and responsibility are intertwined with mutual care and true solidarity, and where progress is measured by the dignity of each person and the good of all peoples. It makes me think of, you know, we as humans, we are pretty frail, and we only live for 40, 50, 60, even 100 years. It's not a long time. And part of being human is accepting our limitations, our frailties, and I love that the way he says it here. We place our hope in unlimited upgrades in form of progress. And if you're thinking about that just as far as what I can get from it, and I know I've fallen into this trap so many times, it is so easy as a nerd when you see the latest gadgets coming out. Like, oh, this is great. It's going to make my life so much better, so much easier, and it's so cool. That, as you said before, we don't think about all of the things that have happened behind the scenes to make that happen. And so then I love how he finishes that. We place our hopes in unlimited upgrades and forms of progress that exacerbate inequalities and in immediate solutions incapable of healing people's wounds.
Yeah. You know, we're both tech nerds too, and I don't think it's necessarily, we love technology, you know, new things that come out, it just excites us. But I think it's the whys behind it that should inform a lot of what we're doing. If we're constantly upgrading, like I love how Pope Leo talks about that, you know, upgrades and quotes, you know, if we're constantly, you know, upgrading and we're progressing toward this goal. I think what he's saying here is what is the goal? Because if that's not helping us heal people's wounds or do things better for humanity or inform our work in a better way to where we're contributing better to society, if it really is just a siloed, hey, I got this new thing, but it's not benefiting anybody, I think that's where you get into this loss of, what does he say here? Mutual care and true solidarity. Because progress is measured by the good of all people, not yep. just, you know, look at how I upgraded my cars and my house and my technology and things yeah. like that. It's how are you caring for your family? How are you caring for your neighbors? How are you caring for your small group that's coming over and enjoying your new refrigerator in your house, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's yeah. as long as there's that goal and that means to an end, I think that's where the difference is. Cause again, we're not saying we all need to be Luddites, right? We're not saying we right. all need to give up technology, but technology.
And we're also not saying that you need to go off and live in a tent.
Right.
Because you shouldn't have any material possessions. You know, one of my sister-in-laws grew up in, I think it was a pretty good sized house when she was growing up, but her parents would bring people in all the time. This was an open place. And if anyone needed a place to stay, their home was open. And so it's not how much you have or how much you don't have.
Right.
It's about how you use the things that you have. Are you caring for the people around you? And we're not all expected to solve all the world's problems, but we are all expected to see the people that have needs around us and do whatever we can to help them.
Right. Right.
And so, and because of their dignity, the dignity of each person and the good of all people. I like that those two are put next to each other.
Yeah. And this is a really good point too, that comes to the wise. I was watching a clip the other day of Pope Leo, and he was talking to a group of kind of grade school children. And what he was saying is, you know, hey, we're all together as a group of people. The best thing you can do is put down your phones, you know, just put them down. You know, he wasn't like, oh, no to technology and it isn't worth it. He's like, no, but true relationships, you know, and are built around, you know, doing the face to face with people and actually interacting with people instead of interacting with the technology. And I really liked that because he wasn't saying throw it out. He was saying, yeah. hey, in this time and space that we're in right now, let's just put it down. You know, let's make sure that we're focusing on the right things and the way we should be. And technology can help with a lot of that, I think, because you're able to get through a lot of barriers that I think we had maybe many, many years ago with technology and how we help people and how we're able to transfer money more quickly to people that need it and things like that. Technology is a great help. Yeah. But not at the expense of building true relationship with the people around you. And again, right. like siloing yourself away from, you know, your neighbor and love right. for your neighbor. Right.
Right. I think at some point we will get into the issues of relationships with the artificial intelligence, which just takes all that to another level of pulling you away from actual connection with people.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, all the stats today, you know, I run a young adult ministry at our parish, and what we always hear is the loneliness of young adults.
Yeah.
The loneliness yeah. and anxiety of people. And a lot of that is informed because of social media. You know, so again, here we get into this whole, you know, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Social media is a great platform for broadcasting things, for pulling people in, for communications yep. that didn't exist before. I think it can be really beneficial, but at the same time, it can be really, you can really silo yourself off. And how are we as a church and as Catholics being cautious with that? I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine who's a canon lawyer, and he said, you know, for fun, you should look up canon law number 666 just when you have an opportunity to, because it's so funny, because that's the canon law that talks about social media use and being careful with it. I know it is funny, but you know, you just think about it and it's like, wow, it's just really is being cautious and not losing sight of what it really means to be human. You know, we're losing touch with that, and we do need to talk about that later. But so what you're mentioning about the relationships with artificial intelligence, okay, we have this gap in relationships, but we're tied to our technology and we're tied to social media. So companies are like, well, we'll help you fill that gap with more technology.
Yes.
Yep. You know, and God is saying, no, I built that human to interact with you.
Yes.
Not away from the interaction. So we're almost moving away from the direction that God wants us to go instead of towards. So kind of bringing us back to the beginning of this conversation is this what God wants us to do?
Yeah. I want to point you, and I'll put the links in the show notes to the, there are two episodes that I did a number of years ago with Todd Engelson is the president of an organization called Peer Servants. And this is it's a microfinance organization that works with all these other microfinance organizations around the world. And so I volunteered with them for about 10 years. And so I was able to do a lot of traveling all over the world to work with some of these other organizations. And to be able to see the use of capital and technology in such a great way that most of the entrepreneurs that were involved in these programs, they would get a first loan of some places $50, but you know, between $50 and $200, they would get a loan and they would buy something to help out either the business that they already had or to start a new business. So, you know, a lot of time that this one story I remember hearing, there was a guy in Moldova. He had been unemployed for years and his wife had gotten some loans. And so he went out and he got a loan for $150 or something. And he went out and he bought some pigs and he butchered them and he sold the meat. And then he went back for another loan, a little bit bigger. He bought some equipment. Well, after I think 7 or 8 loans, he went from being someone who had no work to someone that owned a butcher business that he had 6 or 7 employees. He had created this line of sausages that were so popular that members of the parliament from the country would come down and buy sausages from him. Hmm. He gave money to his church. He was able to support programs in his community. And so with technology, even, you know, we're talking all about AI, but any technology can be used to give people an opportunity that they hadn't had before.
Right.
And I think there is a place for artificial intelligence to do the same thing, to give people a tool that will allow them to do something that they've never done before.
Mm. And not replace it. You know,
right.
I think what you're hitting on there is that I think AI is seen a lot of the times as, oh, we can, if we dream it, you know, we can create it, maybe at the expense of that butcher that you're talking about that had this creative genius inside of him that wasn't able to do it until he had the resources to sort of realize it. And that's where we need to be careful too, is our end goal to help people like that and sort of allow them to live in their creativity and in what God created them to do, you know, in their gifting, or is it a means to an end? That's where the dehumanization comes from things like that. That would have never happened if it weren't for the human behind that. No matter how good artificial general intelligence gets, we'll never be able to tell it, create me the best sausage in the world that Parliament's going to love. It's going to be like, well, I need a resource. Yes. I don't know. I've never seen it.
Exactly.
Right. So it's that creativity.
And what's going to happen is if you rely solely on the AGI, then you're just going to get the same sausage that everyone else has.
That everyone else has.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've gone on a little bit long, so I want to close off the episode, but I want to close it off by reading this last quote from paragraph 15, because I think this is a good summary of what we've been talking about. And then we can wrap up with a few closing thoughts. But in paragraph 15, it says, in the era of artificial intelligence, when human dignity is threatened by new forms of dehumanization, ours is a pressing duty to remain profoundly human. We must lovingly safeguard the grandeur of humanity bestowed upon us and revealed in its fullness in Christ, the splendor of which no machine can ever replace. True progress always stems from a heart open to others, an intelligence willing to listen, and a will that seeks what unites rather than what separates.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Pope Leo jumping into our episode and giving us the perfect mic drop.
Yep, absolutely. No, that's a beautiful way to frame it and to end, because that's, I think, what we've been talking about this entire time is how do we safeguard that humanity? How do we make sure that everything we're doing with artificial intelligence isn't threatening our human dignity, you know?
Yeah.
But we're able to sort of elevate human dignity and use it as the tool that it is, but in the right ways. And I think that takes people that has hearts open to others. You know, it's people that already have that bestowed in them that are using the tools in the right way. Like Pope Leo said earlier, these tools aren't intrinsically evil in and of themselves. It's the people that use them. And so how can we as Catholics help inform the people around us to use these tools the right way, to help serve humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're watching or listening to this, I encourage you to go over to thatnerdycatholic.com/AI. That is the page that we have up on our site. It has the archive of all the episodes that we've done so far on this topic. But there's also a form there that allows you to share some of your thoughts, any questions. But this idea that AI is a tool, and it's not something, you know, we don't want to, you know, as, you know, Lee and I coming from, you know, IT and software backgrounds, we want to understand the tool better. We're not Luddites, as Lee said earlier, that says, well, just throw the technology away. We're also not the technological evangelists that says this is the best thing in the world, you should use it for everything. And so one of the things that we're doing in this whole series on AI, but especially this series that we're going through right now on Magnifica Humanitas, is we want to really wrestle with all the ideas and with the technology itself to say, how can we use this not just because it's cool? How can we use this to benefit the lives of everyone? How can we use this to emphasize the dignity of each person and the good of all? And how can we use this as a tool? Because as you said a number of times in a number of different ways, we can really use this tool to lift people out of some of the problems mm-hmm. in this world. But we could also use this to push people down and manipulate and use people.
Right.
So this is something, there's not a simple answer. This is something that we all need to wrestle through and say, how are we going to allow AI to shape the future?
Right. And how are we going to make sure that we're relying on the right things, that we're always focusing, you know, like we talked about early on in that line that I love from paragraph 2, how are we always allowing the gospel to challenge and direct our human experience?
Yeah.
That should be the source of everything that we do, technology related, whether it's AI or something else that happens in the future. And then once we get that right, you know, we've got the first things first, you know, we're doing the things that we need to. Yeah.
Right. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And we, as I said, head over to thatnerdycatholic.com/AI and share your thoughts with us. And if there's anything that we've missed, any thoughts that you have, any questions, any corrections, you know, we're not perfect. We make mistakes as well. And so we might have said something off in this episode. If you do correct us, please do it gently.
We do make less mistakes than AI, though.
That's true. not the endorsement that people might think it is, but yes. So we want to thank you for joining us. And I encourage you to continue to wrestle with this question. And as you're wrestling with it, think about the people around you and how it is not just benefiting you, but benefiting everyone. And so I encourage you to come back. Next episode, we are going to be jumping into chapter 1 of Magnifica Humanitas, and we're going to keep going deeper into this question of how can we use AI to take care of the people around us. So In closing, I want to remind you, if you go to thatnerdycatholic.com, you can sign up for our email list and get updates when we put out new episodes. If you go to thatnerdycatholic.com/merch, you can get Nerdy Catholic swag, t-shirts, mugs, and prints to show the world that you can be a nerd and a Catholic at the same time. And you can go to thatnerdycatholic.com/support to help support us financially. Our expenses here at That Nerdy Catholic have gone up recently, and any financial support you can give us would be greatly appreciated. You can send a one-off tip or join as a monthly supporter. Lee, thank you for this great conversation.
Thank you, Seth. This was great. What a pleasure.
All right. Talk to you next time.
All right. God bless.
All right. God bless. Bye.
System shut down.